Welcome to the Victory Cigar Podcast. My name is Connor and I'm the host of this show. I will be discussing the latest stories and news from the world of sports, primarily covering the MLB, NFL, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR racing. Thank you for joining me. You are listening to episode 14. So, I'm back. It's been about 5 weeks, I believe, since the last episode. Been very, very, very busy and hadn't been able to get out as many as I'd like. I'd like to have had at least a couple more episodes between now and then, but here we are. The NFL is entering week 7. The MLB playoffs are currently in the respective league's championship series. NASCAR has only got 3 more events remaining in the season. The NHL kicked off last week. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about the MLB playoffs. We're going to talk about the NFL. We're going to talk about NASCAR. I think I'll save the NHL conversation for the next episode, which should be soon, next week. We'll have a longer segment about that and maybe make some predictions and talk early season storylines. That being said, though, the MLB playoffs are currently in the championship series. The Toronto Blue Jays are playing the Seattle Mariners. And the Los Angeles Dodgers are playing the Milwaukee Brewers. So, one league, the series is a bit more compelling than the other. In the NL, the Dodgers took a 3-0 lead on the Brewers in the championship series last night, and Toronto and Seattle are tied 2 games apiece. Seattle went up 2-0. Toronto has rallied back with a couple of big performances offensively. They're heading back to Toronto for 2 games, I think. Yes. No. Toronto has the... I'm thinking here. They had 2 games in Seattle, or in Toronto, 2 games in Seattle. So is it 2-1, like back to Seattle? I'm actually not sure. Regardless, they're headed back to Toronto with the series tied at 2, which does favor Toronto in that capacity because they've been so good at home and so mediocre on the road. However, they did drop the first 2 games at home and then 1-2 on the road. So very difficult to say. We'll see how that shakes out. I think that it favors Toronto now, but at least from the home field advantage and how well they've played at home, for how the teams actually match up against one another, like in a vacuum, I still believe Seattle to be a stronger candidate, but we'll just have to see how that plays out between those two. But over in the NL, the Dodgers and Milwaukee is going pretty much exactly the way that we thought it would. It's 3-0 at Los Angeles right now. If they don't just outright sweep them in the next game, it's probably going to be a gentleman's sweep at worst. So, or really at best, I guess. So, we're looking at a 4 or 5 game series, most likely. The Dodgers are just too strong. Yamamoto throwing a complete game, a 1-run complete game, I believe in game 2. $325 million pitcher. There is a problem that the MLB is going to have to take on headfirst here. There's no other way to sugarcoat it. That problem is the Los Angeles Dodgers. And Dodgers fans can try to pull every excuse in the book out to counter the argument against them, but the argument against them is just gaining momentum day by day, and especially as we go through these playoffs. Because, so what I said at the beginning of the playoffs, I know I didn't record this in a podcast because we didn't get an opportunity to record for the last 5 weeks. But my opinion was that there were two teams in the playoffs that could beat the Dodgers. That they had a realistic chance, at least. The Phillies and the Yankees. The Yankees obviously would have to meet them in the World Series again. I'm a Yankees fan. You know there's some bias there, but hold on. I'll back it up. So Philadelphia is a strong team, and they were a strong team this year. I don't think Philly was a paper tiger. I think Philly was legitimately pretty good. That being said, they had a crack at beating the Dodgers. They lost in game four of that series. They went down 2-0. They won game three to make it 2-1. And they were playing a tight game in game four. Game was tied in the bottom of the 11th, and Orion Kerkering made a horrendous error with two outs with the bases loaded in the bottom of the 11th. He gets a chopper back to him. He bobbles it a little bit on the when going to field it. And he flat out, there's no other way to put it, he flat out panics and picks it up quickly and flings it home way over Realmuto's head off to Realmuto's left. Just absolutely nowhere close for Realmuto to make a play. Realmuto is staring at the pitcher, probably yelling as well, and pointing at first base because he had plenty of time. If you go back and watch the replay, it's not even close. He had plenty of time to make the play and just panicked. Just outright, flat out panicked and flung it over the Realmuto's head at the plate, and they lost. That's how they lost. Who knows if they would have won that game when we moved on to the 12th inning and forward. Who knows if they would have won that game. If they do win that game and they force it to 5 and they go home, though, Philly was lined up for a home game. Man, you kind of have to think they might have had a real shot there going home, winner take all, one game, you know, and they ruined that opportunity. But once the Dodgers moved on past them, that was it. You can hand the World Series ring to the Dodgers. And, you know, I kind of hope I'm wrong when we get to the World Series here. But because I also severely dislike Toronto, so it's not like I'm exactly rooting for them. If Toronto is the one that makes it, I suppose. But I just don't believe that they have anything for the Dodgers. I just don't believe the AL has anything for the Dodgers once the Yankees were eliminated. The Yankees, as so often they have been, much to my torment in the Aaron Judge era in particular, let's be real. To give a quick recap on the Yankees in the Aaron Judge era, 2017 is his rookie year. He obviously gets called up at the end of 2016. But 2017, his full rookie year, breaks out 52 home runs, at the time sets the rookie record, outstanding year. I believe bats .282 with 52 home runs, just absolutely outstanding, breakout superstar season in his rookie year there. The team was very complete. They had a good back end of the bullpen. They had a good, pretty balanced offense. An offensive attack. This was Joe Girardi managing. They had a nice set of starters. They were just a pretty complete team. I maintain to this day that team wins the World Series if the Houston Astros aren't banging on trash cans. I watched that team all year. That team wins the World Series if the Houston Astros are not banging on trash cans. I believe, if I remember correctly, that was a 7-game series against Houston in the CS. Houston wins 2 games at home. They go to Yankee Stadium and lose all 3. They go back home and win game 6 and 7. If the Houston Astros are not banging on trash cans, the Yankees win that World Series. I truly believe it. The Dodgers were good that year, too, and the Dodgers have a legitimate gripe with Houston as well. That series also went 7. They have a legitimate gripe obviously. And they would have been a formidable opponent for the Yankees. But I think the Yankees best them there. I think the Yankees were better than the Dodgers. I think they win that one. And I also maintain that in 2019, I don't know if the Yankees beat the Nationals. The Nationals were very good. I don't know if they beat them. The Nationals, you know, they had Strasburg out of this world, Scherzer pitching out of this world, and the bats of Soto and Rendon. I don't know. I don't know if the Yankees win that one. I'm certain that they put up quite a fight in 19 as well. Again, the Houston Astros were cheating. Houston Astros fans are going to tell you, oh, they only 2017 was it. No, we didn't do anything else. I don't care. If you had a successful system that won you the World Series, you kept doing it. I think everybody with a brain, a.k.a. everybody not from Houston, Texas, and its surrounding metropolitan area, knows that they also used the system in 17, 18, and 19. I believe that if the Yankees pull off that game six, well, I just believe the Yankees beat the Astros in 19 without the system as well. They were very close to forcing a game seven. That was a very scarring experience for me, but they were very close to even forcing a game seven, and possibly maybe they don't need it if Houston is not buzz, trash cans, you know, whatever. Okay. They had a cheating system going on. They were electronically stealing signs and relaying the information to batters. We know this. How they did it, you know, it varied, but we know that they did it. Regardless, that's just to cover them. Since then, I haven't felt that great about a Yankees team. In 17 and 19, those were the juggernaut teams. Those were the ones that I thought were legitimately pretty good, that really had a really good shot. Last year, it's kind of funny. They make the World Series last year with arguably the team that I felt might have been the weakest overall team since 2022, maybe, the Yankees. 23 might have been all right if Judge had not gotten hurt with that low-quality, no-aura loser stadium in Los Angeles. Yeah, my bias fully showing there. That the Dodgers stadium, oh, well, it's one of the oldest. It's a 1960. It has no aura. It has no, nobody cares. That stadium kind of sucks. It's not a cool stadium, and it's outdated, and Aaron Judge screws up his toe in 2023, also breaking up what would end up being like four straight MVPs for him if he doesn't get his toe screwed up there, which is incredibly unfortunate. Anyway, the team last year, I was pulling my hair out all season about Alex Verdugo. I was pulling my hair out all year about Anthony Rizzo. There were just obvious things that because there was too much sway, either Judge had too much say in who was getting playing time or the front office, or Boone just didn't have any balls. But either way, there were major, enormous black holes in the lineup. Those two in particular were just complete and utter zero production from those positions in the lineup. And it's wild after we watched Trent Grisham have the season that he did this year. Trent Grisham was just hanging out on the bench last year. Alex Verdugo was playing every day. It's shocking. Regardless, and heck, Ben Rice. Ben Rice was sitting on the bench last year. And Anthony Rizzo was playing first base. It's just shocking, the malpractice. Regardless, finishing this quick summary of the last the Aaron Judge era. The Yankees are either they go through periods where in every year, I'd say that during the Judge era, I'd say for the most part in every year for about 60% of the season, they look pretty unbeatable. They look like juggernauts. And it's not just against bad teams or anything. It's not just when they play the White Sox and the Rockies or anything like that. They go through some stretches where they will beat some good teams and they put together some great winning streaks and they're putting together some complete baseball. You know, the offense clicks, they're scoring runs, the pitching is lights out, the bullpen is beautiful, whatever. They do that and you see that as a fan for a large, during the years that they've been good here. During the Judge era, they've been good just about every year. Just how good is, it varies. But there, you'll get about 60% of the year where you feel really good, like, man, if they play like this, if this clicks in October, they can do it. And, you know, some years with some teams, you don't see that. You know, you don't see that. Some years you see just an inconsistent, floundering sort of mess all year. And with not just the Yankees, but with other teams is what I mean. But with them in recent years, it's felt like they've played just over half the season. They feel really good. Another large chunk of the year, though, usually about 25% of it, they look like the worst team you've ever seen. They flounder, they're lost, they're just, the offense can't hit. You know, they're going 10 straight games where they're scoring under 3 runs, you know, and the pitchers blow up. There's just this weird spot for them, and it always seems to happen in the summer. It always seems to happen in July and August in particular. They always seem to kind of right the ship around the end of August, like back half of August. It's like mid-June to mid-August. You get this weird spot that they go through where they just look terrible and you lose all confidence in them. So that's not like 40% of the season, but it's 25 to 30% of the season is what you see. And then that other 10 to 15% that's left unaccounted for is where... It is the part of the year where they look good, but you don't know how good. You know, they're kind of that's the inconsistent part or whatever. That's the more like up and down, like just straight up. That's the type of 10-15 game stretch where they go 500 and you're like, I just don't know if this team is good or not. And so you get like, I think a little over the majority, you know, about 60%, they look really good. And then you get a good chunk where they look really bad. And then another little bit, you know, sprinkled here and there where you just don't know who they are. And you get some really high highs and some really low lows in that other 10 or 15%. Like you get a stretch where they beat somebody down 12-1 and then they beat somebody 12-1, then 8-0. And then they lose a game 6-0 and 9-1, and you'll get a couple of stretches like that. Anyway, the Yankees. My position before the playoffs started. Sorry, I got off about 10 minutes there on some looping around about recapping the Yankees here, but I felt as though at the beginning of the playoffs, the Phillies could knock out the Dodgers. And if the Yankees and Dodgers met again in the World Series, I thought it would go a lot better for New York. If New York played the way that I know they were capable of playing. This team this year had probably the roughest rough stretch in recent memory through the summer that I've seen. But at their best, they also looked better than I've seen in a long time. At their best. That being the key thing. They went into the playoffs on a heater. They chased the Blue Jays down for the top spot in the division. They tied them. They just needed Toronto to lose one game. And Toronto didn't. They chased them down and they tied their record, but they lost the season series against Toronto by one game, and therefore lost the tiebreaker and lost the division. Because they played the majority of their games against Toronto, I believe, during the really rough stretch in the summer. If they'd played the majority of their games against Toronto in the spring or the majority in the fall, they win the division. But they played the majority of their games against them when they were playing their worst baseball. And they dropped the division. That's the way it goes. And so therefore, they lost home field advantage when they would end up playing Toronto in the division series. Yankees, of course, would end up, instead of getting a first round bye, we'd have to stress our way through the Red Sox series, which I thought they would lose to Boston after Crochet beat them in game one. That was kind of to be expected, but it just really upset me, and I really thought they were cooked because they were so close. They could have won that game and saved themselves a lot of stress. They absolutely could have won that game. They had their opportunity. They had the bases loaded in the bottom of the ninth and nobody out. They could have won that game, and they didn't. And Fried was brilliant in that game as well. But they ended up taking the next two, and they beat the Red Sox, sent them packing, thank God. But they played Toronto, and I felt okay. They had not played well overall against Toronto, but I felt okay in the longer series versus, like, the Boston series was a shorter series. But Toronto came out slugging. Toronto, just for some reason, they just had their number. And for some reason, Toronto plays really well at home this year. And they came out swinging and just kicked our butt in game one and two. And, at that point, yeah, I shut off game two when it went 2-0. I went, I can't watch that. Shut it off, didn't turn it back on. Game three, I watched. I shut it off when it got to 6-1 or 6-0, I think. When it got to 6-0, I shut it off for an inning, I want to say. And then I turned it back on when the Yankees made it 6-3. Turned it back on because, I just couldn't watch them get blown out again. But it was 6-3. Turned it back on, said, okay, let's see what happens here. Judge hits that mammoth home run. Expels those demons. Judge had a great playoffs. He had a great postseason. He struck out in that key spot with the bases loaded in game one against Toronto. That could have changed the series if he comes through there. But Giancarlo Stanton also had a chance to come through there. Giancarlo Stanton was uncharacteristically awful in the playoffs this year. Very strange. And I'm not just saying that because he had an amazing postseason last year. Giancarlo Stanton, historically, with the Yankees since he got here in 2018, Giancarlo Stanton has been excellent in the playoffs for the Yankees. He's been outstanding every year. And he had a great year when he came back from injury in the regular season this year. He was awesome. I think he was batting like .280 or higher. With the power and everything, Stanton was great. He looked like old Miami Stanton. It was kind of wild. And he just folded in the playoffs. Very strange for him. Very, very strange. So Stanton could have come up big there, and I think Jazz might have bat, and he didn't come up. So basically three guys failed at their job there with the bases loaded in that game one against Toronto. But Judge had a great postseason. I think he batted close to .500 the postseason. He had some big hits, and he exercised the demons. Judge has not been good in the postseason up to this point. I still truly believe in my heart of hearts, it felt like he figured it out. He finally had figured it out last year in the World Series. He kind of looked like he started to figure it out in the back half of the Cleveland series, last two games of the Cleveland series. And I think he'd fully really figured it out by game three of the World Series. The problem was that, they went down 3-0 at that point. He had, if I remember right, Judge had a great, good games at the plate in game 3, 4, and 5. But He made the error in center field in game five. Anthony Rizzo doesn't cover the bag. The whole nightmare that unfolded there. I really, truly still believe, too. I don't know if they win, but I think the Yankees make that a seven-game series in the World Series last year if they don't blow game five, because the Dodgers' pitching was in shambles. They were out of starters. They were going to have to do bullpen games. They were kind of in trouble there. And if they took it to six, I think they would have taken it to seven. I don't know that they win, you know, at the end there, but I think that they get there. I think they might have actually done it, but they just catastrophically blew it. So that's a moot point now. Anyway, the Yankees, I think, could have matched up against the Dodgers this year and had a chance to beat them if they played their best ball. The problem is that they just didn't. They just didn't. They rallied in one game three against Toronto, and then they just collapsed again game four. I mean, just they went out pretty lifeless. And that hurt. You know, that hurt. But at the same time, I'm also kind of good riddance to this team. There were some good things about this team. Some guys that it was fun to watch Trent Grisham perform and Cody Bellinger have a great year and everything. But at the same time, it's pretty disgusting when you look at the playoff statistics of the hitters in particular. Man, it was basically Aaron Judge did everything and nobody else did a single thing. It was really quite putrid, actually. It was like everybody else on the team had an OPS under 600. It was just quite literally nobody else stepped up at all in any capacity. And that you're just not going to win games like that. You're just not going to win games in the playoffs like that. Everybody else folded. And which is incredible, because in previous years there'd be other guys that stepped up and had great postseasons, and you know, and Judge didn't step up. You know, Judge kind of was league average, basically, you know, OPSs of about 740 or something like that, you know, when we're used to seeing 1,000 plus from him. Judge had basically some average performances in previous playoffs when other guys stepped up. The year that he steps up and has a 1,400 OPS or something like that, and is incredible and is batting almost 500, nobody else steps up. So that's just awesome. Regardless, once the Yankees were eliminated, that was it. I just don't think it'd be nice if the Dodgers didn't win the World Series, but I just don't see it happening. I think they've kind of got this one wrapped up. And which leads me to my next point and the last thing to talk about for the MLB here. But I really, people are half joking, half serious, but I think we're headed for a lockout in 2027. I don't think we're playing baseball in 2027. This is a problem, and Dodgers fans can try, as I mentioned earlier, they can try to counter this in any way, shape, or form that they want, but here is the basic truth to the situation. The Dodgers have got unreal amounts of money being deferred to a later date, creating a loophole in the salary cap system. They have... I mean, is it over $1 billion now? They're deferring almost $700 million on just Otani. And then I know that some of the guys that they signed after that have got deferred. Like, I think Blake Snell's got deferred money in there, if I'm not mistaken. Yamamoto might too, I'm not sure. Regardless, the Dodgers have spent billions of dollars on players in the last few years. You know, Mookie Betts, his contract was over $300 million. Freddie Freeman was close to $200 million, I think. Otani at $700 million, Yamamoto at $325 million, Snell at what, $180 million? They and that's just those guys. I think, didn't they bring back Teoscar Hernandez for like $30 million a year, like $100 million deal total or something? They the amount of guys, they got Sasaki for next to nothing, where there was clear collusion there. They have built a ridiculous super team that just can't be matched. And so there will be some people, and Dodgers fans would chime in on this too, that would go, well, the other owners are worth lots of money too. They need to spend money. That they can't do that. Even Steve Cohen, who is worth $21 billion and owns the Mets, Steve Cohen can't spend like that. Cohen, what these people don't understand, with these Dodgers fans that defend this, or others that defend the system, well, then everybody else will spend money. Like, because people will tell you with a straight face that the Yankees and the Mets and the Giants and Toronto or anybody else that has really rich owners and stuff, well, they can do the same thing. They can't. You know why? I'm going to tell you why. Two major, major factors. Okay? One, this is kind of a little known thing. I don't see this get brought up that often when this is being discussed, because they kind of only discuss the things that are in between the lines. But the Dodgers have an insane advantage that no other team in the major leagues has right off the bat every single year. So these teams, you know, teams operate on their revenue, total revenue that they bring in, and then payroll and costs and everything going out. So of course, the bills of all the stuff they have to pay that's related to the team, the stadium, the concessions, the taxes, the utilities, the whole thing, all that stuff, right? That's operating cost for the stadium itself and for the team. That's the team operating cost. Factored into the team operating cost then is, of course, the player contracts, the stuff that they have to pay out every year. So the teams are, what they're trying to do is that they're not running these teams where they're taking a loss every year. They have to figure out, okay, we're going to bring in, this is how much revenue we expect to bring in, so this is how much we can spend payroll, because I would like to make a 5% profit this year. I'd like to make a 10% profit this year, whatever, on the team. So if it costs me between all the, if the team's going to bring in $300 million on the year, $200 million, let's say $300 million, it's going to bring in $300 million of total revenue. My operating costs between contracts and all the other stuff to do with running the team and everything, paying all the salaries, are $280 million. So it's a $20 million profit, right? They can't operate it at a loss. So if they pay out so much stuff that they have $400 million in operating costs and they're bringing in $300 million, they're going to lose $100 million. No owner, nobody. And no one here, you know, that nobody defending this could say, oh, if it was me, yeah, I'd just lose $100 million a year on my team. No. I don't care if you're worth, you know, $21 billion like Steve Cohen is. He's not going to take hundreds of millions. He's not going to take millions of dollars of loss every year. Maybe here and there, they'd be willing to do it. You know, maybe if the right opportunity, the right contracts come up or whatever, they're willing to go, you know what, yeah, this year we got all this going on, but we've got money coming off the books next year, which would put us back in the green. I will take a $40 million loss this year to see if we can put a better team on the field, whatever. Some owners might do that. Others will never do that. Some will. Steve Cohen's a guy that probably would. The problem with this is, so just keep that basic framework in mind. So what are some ways that teams make revenue? What are some ways they make money? Selling merchandise, selling concessions, selling tickets. Okay, all that stuff, right? You go to a game, you buy a t-shirt, you get a beer and some nachos, and of course you bought the ticket and everything. That's how they make some money. That's money right there. Okay. you know, and all their other merchandise that they sell online. You buy a t-shirt from wherever, they're making money on all this stuff, right? That's probably the most direct way that people relate to them making money. Something else, though, they make money by the television networks as basically as part of the television revenue. So, for example, the Yankees are on the YES Network, okay? And the YES Network is owned by whoever, you know, it goes all the way up the ladder and everything. But the Yankees are being paid a certain amount of money for the broadcasting rights to the team, for the games. Pretty much everybody in Major League Baseball has a deal with somebody, okay? For the, like, the Yankees are on YES, for example. They have their own network, right? But, for example, like all growing up here with the Texas Rangers and everything, the Rangers were on Fox Sports Southwest, which was then bought by Bally Sports Southwest, which then went under. However, let's just go back to the Fox Sports Southwest example as the best way to, you know, make this simple. So on Fox Sports Southwest, I can't tell you all of them exactly. But back in the day, so let's say 15, 20 years ago, Fox Sports Southwest had Ranger games. So if you lived, you know, as long as your cable package had the Fox Sports channel or whatever, if you lived in this area, in the Dallas area, if you lived in Oklahoma, if you lived out a little further west, whatever, you would watch the Rangers games on that channel. If you lived down in the Houston area, down there, you'd watch the Astros on that channel. If you were out towards Arizona or western New Mexico, you would watch the Diamondbacks on that channel. I'm not sure if the Rockies were also on that channel or if they were on, like, Fox Sports West. There was Fox Sports South, Fox Sports Central, I think. Like, there were different, you know, they split the regions up and everything. But the point being was that Fox Sports would pay the Texas Rangers, the Houston Astros, the Arizona Diamondbacks, whatever. They'd say, this is the money. We're going to pay you, you know, $70 million a year to broadcast your games on our network. And they'll sell the advertising space. And that's how the television networks make their money. They sell the ads, you know, all that stuff. And they make their money off the ads and the subscribers. So, that's a large chunk of revenue. So for the New York Yankees, for example, I believe their deal, you would have to think, right? Like, man, the Yankees, they're on their own channel. They probably have a pretty fat revenue deal. Yes, they do. I believe it's around $120 million a year. The team is paid that much money for the broadcasting rights to the team. So the Yankees get to start with that head start. They get $120 million or whatever. I think it's $120 or $140 maybe. Somewhere in that range. They get paid that from the jump. Every year, clock strikes January 1st, and it's like, all right, fresh $120 million to work with here. And let's see what we can pile on top of that from our ticket sales and our merchandise and all the other stuff that we got and everything like that. And selling our advertising space around the stadium and, you know, all that other stuff, and other advertising space, the companies that pay them to put them on billboards and all that. They're partners, right? But that's the head start they get. For other teams, that head start is much smaller. For the living here in Dallas, the Texas Rangers, they had their operating television deal was in shambles the last several years, and it affected payroll. It affected what they could spend on free agents. Because for the Rangers, once Fox Sports sold to Bally, or Bally bought the rights to the thing, or I don't know if Fox Sports sold the, I don't know what happened there. I think Bally just bought the rights. But Bally Sports, of course, went under. Bally, yes, the Bally of the casino fame. They went under. They couldn't pay they weren't paying the teams they were supposed to be paying for the broadcast rights all over the country. They bought up a bunch of these, you know, broadcast rights. But their deal I remember, I think I remember reading something about how the deal with Bally was supposed to be around 100 million, 80 to 100 million, something like that. And like I said, I think the Yankees were about 120 to 140, somewhere in there. So, you know, but they were at a much higher advantage. I think when the Rangers were with Fox Sports Southwest, it was about 70 million a year. So that just tells you, like, the difference between that. The Yankees have been on this deal, I think, for about the last 15 years or something. So, even if we went back 10 or 15 years ago when it was Fox Sports, the Texas Rangers were going to get like $70 million to spend towards their revenue to spend on the team and operations from Fox Sports. But the Yankees were going to get 120 or 140 or whatever. They were going to get a lot more. So that's key number one. This is something that's not brought up when discussing this problem that we have with the Dodgers spending ludicrous amounts of money and the discussions around salary caps and salary floors and everything else. You have any idea what the Dodgers television revenue brings them? What their deal is? What their deal that is good through 2038? Signed in 2013. 25-year deal. You know how much of a head start the Los Angeles Dodgers have been getting since 2013 on every other team in the league? $334 million a year. An $8.35 billion deal. They have a $334 million head start. $334 million is what, and possibly more, than some teams make in total revenue for the year. Absurd. So I have the list here, the revenue list, with the payroll and tax and luxury tax they had to pay. The Miami Marlins made $317 million in revenue. They had $86 million in payroll. But their revenue that was brought in was $317 million. Chicago White Sox revenue brought in $277, Tampa Bay $297, Pittsburgh $326, Cleveland $336, Milwaukee $335, Washington $325, Cincy $325, the Athletics $257, Colorado $318, Detroit $320, the Royals $324. The Diamondbacks, 328. So those are the teams I just read off either had the same, roughly the same, or under the amount of money that the Dodgers get from television alone. And that was their total revenue for the year. The Dodgers, so let's count the amount there. Teams last year had roughly the same or lower total revenue for the entire year from their television and all, you know, business dealings, all their partners and all their ticket sales and all their merch and all their hot dogs and $15 beers. All 14. That's almost, in a league of 30 teams, that's almost half the league. They have a head start greater than half the league off just television, which is why when you look at this chart and you look at the total revenue, so for example, where's the Yankees? The Yankees brought in $728 million. So they brought in a lot, and that's to be expected. The Yankees are, you know, love them or hate them, the Yankees are a worldwide brand. They're recognized for their long storied history, their championships, their great players, all that stuff. They make a lot of money. Don't get me wrong. The team makes a lot of money. Their television deal is nowhere near the Dodgers. So the Yankees are making that revenue, you know, between their advertising partners and their sales for the most part. The Dodgers, their revenue last year was $752 million. They were number one. Number one in revenue stream, but with almost half of that money coming off the jump from the get with their revenue from the television deal. Crazy. They, absolutely crazy. That is why we're headed for a lockout in 2027. That right there. They have an inherent disgusting advantage over half of the league immediately. And that's just number one. That's just the first part of this equation. But that's one that is not brought up. It is not discussed nearly as much as when having these conversations as one might think. That's something that not a lot of people know. And there's no way for Dodgers fans to defend that. There's no way. I mean, good for the team for negotiating the deal and all that and building the brand and all that. That's great stuff from a capitalist perspective, right? Of making your money and you know, transforming your business and making money, great. Its impact on the rest of the league, however, is incredibly detrimental. It's just that they can count on so much more money that they can make that they can spend on other players that other teams simply can't. So when you say, oh, well, you know, the guy that owns Cleveland's worth a lot of money, they should spend some more money. I agree that the Cleveland Guardians should spend more money. I think the owner should spend more money on more players and payroll and try to put a better team on the field. I don't disagree with that sentiment at all. I do think there are other teams that need to open up their wallet, you know, and keep their homegrown star players the fans love and all that stuff. They gotta show some commitment to the teams and the or to the players and the fans. It is absolutely a problem, no question about it. Not gonna argue that. However, there's two sides to that coin. Where just that some of these other teams are sitting there going, we can't compete with that. We simply can't compete. There's no reason for us to spend the money because we can't compete with that. Which brings me to point number two. Yeah, the evil billionaires, those evil, evil billionaires. They're all rich and they're all just hoarding the money and not spending it. Those evil, evil men. Okay. Hal Steinbrenner, that owns the Yankees, is worth, let's double check it so we're not talking out of our ass. Hal Steinbrenner is worth $1.6 billion. The Yankees are estimated to be worth $7.55 billion as a franchise. That being said, I do believe that if the Yankees ever came up for sale, they'd sell for a lot more than that. That's the Forbes estimate. You know, Forbes always does estimates every year, every other year or something about what teams are worth. And then when some team comes up for sale, it kind of blows that number out of the water. Like, I believe the Washington Commanders recently sold for, what was it, like $6 billion or something. I think, let's look that. Yeah, $6.05 billion. If the Washington Commanders sold for $6 billion, and Forbes is evaluating the Yankees at 7.5, no, the Yankees would sell for probably closer to double the Forbes number. If the Washington Commanders were worth $6 billion, the Yankees are worth like 12. It's so that being said, that's Hal Steinbrenner's personal net worth of $1.6 billion. The team is worth many billion more than that. However, let's look at some other rich owners. There's other, you know, it's like Rogers Telecommunications that owns the Blue Jays and everything, and they're worth tons and tons of money, which is why we see them throw out crazy figures every year in free agency trying to convince people to move to Canada. Of course, Steve Cohen, that owns the Mets, is worth, supposedly has a net worth of around $21 billion. Lots of money, right? You know how much money backs the Los Angeles Dodgers? Just think about it. I'm going to give you a few seconds of dead air time to think about it and give me your guess. Have you thought about it? They have the Guggenheim Baseball Management Group, as I believe the ownership group behind the Dodgers. Guggenheim Investments has something like $350 billion worth of assets. The investment group, let me repeat that. The investment group behind the Los Angeles Dodgers has $350 billion worth of assets. We're not playing baseball in 2027. So therein are your two key factors behind this argument that just simply can't be refuted in any way, shape, or form by anybody that's a Dodgers fan that's defending the system currently. They have the ridiculous head start in the TV revenue that, you know, they can then, from there, they have just an excellent springboard to work from. And partners are worth $350 billion. They have unlimited funds. That's just the fact of the matter. They have unlimited funds to throw at the team. No other team in baseball has the ability to do that. Hal Steinbrenner does not have the ability to do that. Steve Cohen does not have the ability to do that. Nobody else has the ability. The Rogers don't have the ability to do that. Rogers Telecommunications can't do that. The Giants guys can't do it. Nobody else can do it. No one else. Only the Dodgers. They have an unlimited blank check every offseason. They're going to have to find a way to fix that. Yes, the games are won and lost on the field and not on paper. You can sign all the star players you want, and you might not win at all. You might lose to a scrappy group of contenders, but more often than not, it's going to go their way. Let's just be real. That's the problem. That's why we're not playing baseball in 2027. They got to figure it out. Moving on from baseball. We went on for quite a while about baseball there. I wasn't quite anticipating to go that far, but I had to cook the Dodgers or explain that situation for the last 20 minutes. That being said, I'll keep it shorter on the NFL this week than other weeks. We're just kind of, so we had the, today is Friday, October 17th. So we had the Steelers and Bengals play last night on Thursday Night Football, and actually a good game. Flacco and Rodgers slinging it. Bengals defeating the Steelers, surprisingly, 33-31 in a pretty good game. This week we have the Rams and Jaguars, the Saints and Bears, Dolphins, Browns, Raiders, Chiefs, Eagles, Vikings, Panthers, Jets, Patriots, Titans, Giants, Broncos, Colts, Chargers, Packers, Cardinals, Commanders, Cowboys, Falcons, 49ers, and another stupid Monday night doubleheader of Buccaneers, Lions, Texans, Seahawks. So I absolutely hate the Monday night doubleheaders, but Monday night football needs to be special. It needs to be, it's one game. It's a premier game. They need to stop this nonsense. I know it's money. It's cash money is what they're doing here. They're making more money, but they got to stop it. It's ridiculous. Interestingly, we don't have any teams that look like absolute wagons, you know, this year. I have the division standings up here as well. The Patriots lead the AFC East. They actually surpassed the Bills because the Bills lost this week, and New England beat the Bills head-to-head 2 weeks ago. So New England on top at 4-2, with Buffalo also at 4-2. Dolphins are awful. Mike McDaniel is getting fired soon. Tua Tagovailoa is absolutely terrible, but that's something I could have told you 5 years ago. The New York Jets are absolutely terrible, and that's something I could have told you 55 years ago and counting. The Pittsburgh Steelers are solid. They probably should have won last night. But Rodgers threw a costly pick earlier in the game, and the Steelers just couldn't stop him. But the Steelers look pretty good. Old man Rodgers has looked pretty good. So that's pretty interesting there. The Bengals are 3-4, trying to hold the fort down while Joe Burrow is still going to be out for an extended period of time, thus the trade for Joe Flacco from the Browns, who are tied with the Ravens at the bottom of the division for the worst record, with the Ravens at 1-5 and the Browns at 1-5. Ravens, of course, have been without Lamar Jackson for the last couple of games. I think Lamar is coming back soon. That being said, the biggest issue with the Ravens is the injuries. I don't think the Ravens inherently stink at all. You know, they have way too good of a track record, especially with the personnel that's been there the last couple of years. What's interesting is I really don't know. They've got a lot of impactful injuries. And that they legitimately have an excuse. They're just beat up. And I think that it depends on the timing of when certain people come back for them. But I think the division is gone. You know, the Steelers should kind of coast that. It would take a ridiculous amount of hot streak from the Ravens. But the Ravens are still a threat in my mind to push for a wild card spot. They could do it. It depends on when those injured people come back. It depends on when the impactful players get back on the field. I would still say it's doubtful. Obviously, at 1-5, it's very bleak, but it's kind of wide open. It's kind of wide open. Let me finish going over the AFC, and I'll come back to that. The Colts are 5-1, which is kind of utterly shocking, right? With Daniel Jones taking over, and they're actually sitting here winning games. The sort of underlying metric there, though, is that they've beat the Dolphins. They beat the Broncos by one. That was a good win. You know, the Broncos are a solid team. And they beat the Dolphins, the Broncos, the Titans, the Raiders, and the Cardinals. They lost to the Rams. What's the theme that we see there? The Broncos are a decent team. They beat them by one. They beat Miami. They're awful. They beat the Titans. They're awful. They beat the Raiders. They're awful. They beat the Cardinals. They're awful. It's the Colts have been, they've been kind of cruising here. And in the back half of the year, I think that things get a bit tougher for them. They might still find their way to a playoff spot. But from here forward, they have the Chargers this week. Chargers are a good team. They have the Titans again. They're terrible. I could really just go over the games they could lose. They have the Steelers on the schedule. They have the Chiefs on the schedule. They have Jacksonville, who's played better this year, so who knows by the time we get to that point, though. They got Seattle on there. They got San Francisco on there. They got the Texans on there twice. They got the Jags on there twice. It could get a lot rougher for them down the stretch. They might prove us all wrong, but I'm just saying. Beyond that, the Jaguars are 4-2. Texans are 2-3, but the Texans are kind of a team that I don't know who they are. I don't know if they're, it's hard to say yet. Give it 2 weeks and it might be, yep, Texans are awful, or it could be Texans, maybe they're showing us something. I don't know. They're a very weird team to me, very inconsistent. Titans are awful. They're 1-5 at the bottom of the AFC South. Over in the AFC West, the Chargers currently lead the division at 4-2 over the Broncos, also at 4-2. The Chiefs are 3-3 in third place in the AFC, and the Raiders are 2-4 and in last place in the AFC West. The Chiefs at 3-3 is obviously very deceptive. I think the Chiefs are kind of possibly... The Chiefs look better than they have in the last couple of years. And you go, well, how is that so? They're 3-3. Last year they started off whatever they were, like 13-0 or 14-0 or something, right? Well, because Patrick Mahomes, it seems as though that bald moron, Matt Nagy, has remembered that he has God himself at quarterback. The last couple years, for some reason, Matt Nagy thought that he had Derek Carr at quarterback for him. And he's throwing a lot of screens and checkdowns and 3-yard outs and, you know, not taking any shots. He kind of forgot that Jesus was in a number 15 at quarterback for him. It seems as though, whether somebody took Nagy aside or Andy Reid or somebody remembered that God plays quarterback for them. And they have unleashed him again to where we're seeing this sort of, I won't say vintage, but we're seeing like the kind of offense that we used to see out of Kansas City years ago. We're seeing this, the deep attack. Like, we're taking deep shots and we're playing more aggressive up the field, and we're just seeing a more well-rounded offense out of them and a more explosive presentation out of them than we've seen in recent memory, the last couple of years from Kansas City. Their defense has kind of let them down to a degree in a couple of these games, but the offense seems to be clicking, and Mahomes is cooking. Mahomes is putting up MVP numbers right now, no matter how you slice it. They lost to the Chargers. You know, first game of the year, that was off in freaking Brazil or something. Really stupid. They lost by 6 there. They lost to Philly, and the old grab Jalen Hurts' butt and push him nonsense. Jalen Hurts is awful, by the way. Just wanted to throw that in there. They beat the Giants. That was still Giants under Russell Wilson, under center. They beat the Ravens, who were... that was the game that Lamar got hurt in, but they beat them very soundly. They lost to the Jaguars. Defense really let them down there, basically, 38-21 or 31-28. But then they just blew out Detroit, who is considered one of the best teams in the league. I mean, they just blew them out at home last week. So I think we're going to see the Chiefs kind of steadily picking wins in the win column here, and I think there's no doubt that they'll end up in the playoffs in some capacity. We just has to see whether they shake out better against the Broncos and Chargers down the stretch throughout the year. That coming back to the Ravens thing I said, though, the reason why I said that even at 1-5 is because the talent is there. It's just a matter of whether they get healthy and get on the field. And if Baltimore, if the talent gets on the field, if they get healthy and they get going, you know, they have winnable games, you know, coming up for them. They have games against the Bears, Dolphins, Vikings, Browns, Jets, Bengals. They got the Bengals two more times, you know, like they got some winnable games on here is what I would have meant, to where if they can kind of, if they get, basically just if they get healthy, as I said, if they get healthy, they have a chance. The way that you look at it is that if they go, what do they play, 17 games now? If they end up going, what would that work out to? 9-8? Does that get them a playoff spot? It could. it could. The thing is that the AFC, the Dolphins are completely god awful at 1-5. The Jets are 0-6. The Browns are 1-5. The Titans are 1-5. The Raiders are 2-4. It's like I said. There's not a lot of, and the thing being there that those teams are awful, of course, but that at the top, you don't have any real wagons. You got a bunch of 4-2s. At the top, as we sit right now, and this is way too early, right? But it's like, could we fast forward a few weeks and the Broncos are 5-5, 6-5 in a few weeks? You know, you get what I'm saying? It's like, if Baltimore, if they get to 9-8 or something like that, can you see a spot where they maybe sneak in? Because we see some other teams kind of fold and fumble and collapse. Possibly. So I obviously still don't, you know, I'm leaning towards doubtful, because 1-5 is just a horrendous, that's just a really big hole to climb out of. So I still think doubtful. I'm just saying, you never know. You do never know. That's the only team in the AFC that you could say that about. It's not going to happen for the Raiders or the Titans or the Browns. Or the Jets or anything. It's not going to happen for them. But that's the one team where they could string them together real quick. And they could be back in the picture and they could be a problem. So we'll see. Over in the NFC, Eagles at 4-2 in the top of the East. Commanders at 3-3. They lost a heartbreaker for them against the Bears on Monday, and with the ball being fumbled, the Jaden Daniels never had the snap, really, when they were handing it off, trying to burn clock. With the lead, they fumble the ball, they lose on a field goal to the Bears, they're 3-3. Cowboys are 2-3, they're 2-3-1, because they tied against Green Bay. Very, very real reality, a real possibility that the Cowboys are sitting at 1-5 right now. They are not a good football team. They are very bad. Their defense is very, very bad. Bad football team. If Brandon Aubrey doesn't make two unreal kicks, they lose to the Giants. Really, if Aubrey doesn't bail them, or if the Packers defensive coordinator remembers that they have to line up proper sets. Basically, they really should have lost to Green Bay, and they very, very easily and realistically probably should have lost to the Giants. So there's a world that they're 1-5, and it's not a very unrealistic world to stretch to, let's put it that way. But they're 2-3-1, but they're not doing anything. That defense is just so unbelievably bad. They're not going to do anything. The Packers are 3-1-1 at the top of the NFC North, with Detroit following them at 4-2, the Vikings at 3-2, and the Bears at 3-2. So the NFC North, again, being a competitive division, it was like that last year. The South, the Buccaneers at 5-1, the Falcons at 3-2, the Panthers weirdly at 3-3, them just beating Dallas last week, which is crazy. The Saints at 1-5, the 49ers at 4-2, the Seahawks at 4-2, the Rams at 4-2, and the Cardinals at 2-4. So we have a very different picture in the NFC than the AFC, with the same thing going on towards the top, where there's no super wagons here. There's nobody that you look at and go, they're the team to beat or anything. We look and it's like, you know, Green Bay's good, Detroit's good, Tampa Bay's good. That's just kind of how you feel. But there's no real, like, nobody really running away or really blowing you away. But very different picture towards the bottom. There are far less really low-quality teams here in the NFC than there are in the AFC, which will become interesting come playoff time, or when we start, you know, shaking into these playoff pictures in the next however many weeks. But that's what's going on over there in the NFC. We'll see how things go this week in this slate of games. We got a couple division matchups throughout, a couple good games on deck. So we'll see how that shakes out, and we'll talk more about it as the season progresses, I'm sure. But that's kind of a current look and kind of where I think things are at. Really hard to pick a favorite. If I had to pick who I think the best team in each conference is, though, I'd really have to say I'm just not counting out the Chiefs. They're just, Mahomes is just ridiculous, and he's playing at a really high level. I can't say that they're not one of the top three favorites over in that conference for sure. I don't know. I've been saying it. I said it last year, just watching bits and pieces of Patriots games. Drake May is legit. That kid's for real. That's a good quarterback. I said it last year. He's a good quarterback. I don't know how far New England's going to go this year, but he's good. Yeah, I don't know. The AFC is tough. I think Pittsburgh with old man Rodgers is solid. I'd like to see Pittsburgh really, what I want to see out of them to become more of a believer is they need to blow out some teams. I need to see some heavy blowouts. They've won some close ones. And yeah. But kind of beyond that in the AFC, Josh Allen's great, and it's hard to count out Buffalo and everything, but he's not looked great this year. Outside the first game. I know he's a great player, but he's been turning the ball over, and Buffalo kind of goes as he goes. And they've lost two in a row. They really arguably, if the Ravens weren't stunningly incompetent, they should have lost the first week. Which means that, so if we look at the schedule, they beat Baltimore by one in that crazy, crazy game where, yeah, just Baltimore was just stunningly incompetent with the way that they managed the end of that game. Realistically, Buffalo should have lost that game for just being real. Then they beat the Jets, the Dolphins, and the Saints, but then they lost to New England and Atlanta. So if we're looking at it like that, they're a 3-3 team. And that's been evident in Allen's play this year. So it's hard for me to really say that, like, they're a favorite, because they don't look great. But that could change at any time, because Josh Allen is a great player. That could change at any time. He could turn it on and lock in, and they could, you know, suddenly they could start flying. So we'll just have to revisit this, you know. If I had to pick, let's say I'm going to pick three from both sides. Okay. So in the AFC, no particular order. I'm going to take as the teams that I think are the best. I'm going to take the Chiefs, the Chargers, and I think the Steelers. I don't know. Yeah, I know the Colts are 5-1. I know the Jaguars are 4-2 with the Steelers too. But I just kind of, you know, Rodgers is playing good football, and if the Steelers defense really locks in too, and the Steelers are good. The Steelers are good. How good? I don't know. Kind of as I said earlier, how good? I don't know. We fast forward 4 weeks and maybe that's, I'm sitting here going, yep, that was a cold take. Very stupid, boys. Steelers are terrible. Who knows? We'll see. In the NFC though, I'm going to say my top three in the NFC. I'm going to have to say that the Buccaneers are in there. Mayfield's been very good. The Lions are in there. And excuse me. Man, it's either the Packers. It's either the Packers or Washington as my third team, I think. The Rams are kind of a strong contender for one of those spots too. Again, another few weeks might create an easier gap to pick a top three, but that's what I would say right now. Moving on to NASCAR. NASCAR. We have Talladega this weekend, the Yellowwood 500, Sunday, October 19th, 2 p.m. We have the Xfinity 500 from Martinsville on October 26th at 2 p.m. Eastern. And then we have the Cup Series finale, the championship race at Phoenix on Sunday, November 2nd at 3 p.m. Denny Hamlin won at Las Vegas last week. Shane Van Gisbergen won by a million miles at the Roval the previous week. Chase Elliott stole a victory in a thriller from Kansas a few weeks ago. Ryan Blaney won at New Hampshire. I was there. And then Christopher Bell won at Bristol. For that, and I believe, I think my last podcast episode actually was the day before the race at Worldwide Technology Raceway, where Denny Hamlin won. So those are the winners since the last time I had an episode. Keeping it really short on this particular thing, the playoffs are stupid. Like, if we know this, I'm not going to rant about it an incredibly long amount of time here. The playoffs are stupid. Denny Hamlin is already in the championship race. He won last week. He's advanced to the championship round. Therefore, nothing that Denny Hamlin does this week or next week matters at all. Denny Hamlin can finish last this week. He can finish last next week. Does not matter. He's competing for the championship because he won at Las Vegas. Currently above the cut line of eight drivers, they get cut down to four. Kyle Larson's 35 points to the good, Christopher Bell 20 points, and Briscoe 15 to the good. Three Toyotas and one Chevy right there to the good. However, this is Talladega this week. There's going to be big wrecks. We have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. It's so volatile. No clue. That could be very shook up by the time that we're headed to Martinsville the next week. Below the cut line is William Byron. by 15 points, Chase Elliott by 23, Logano by 24, and Ryan Blaney by 31. Yeah, so here's the thing. Ryan Blaney finished last at Las Vegas there, which put him in a very, very deep hole. Joey Logano did not, they took a gamble and they had a little bit better of a race than they were going to have, but they weren't doing great. Chase Elliott had a great car, a top five, probably top three type car at Las Vegas. His team, however, late in the second stage, had an uncontrolled tire penalty. He had to come down pit road, lost the lap, completely and totally screwed up their strategy for the race. Really screwed them really, really bad because he was headed for a top five day and would probably be above the cut line right now if that had happened. However, he did not. William Byron also had a top three car in speed. He was running second to Kyle Larson at the time of this particular incident. But Ty Dillon did not signal. Nobody signaled. Nobody told anybody that Ty Dillon was coming to pit road as he came out of turn four. And he slowed down and dropped down the track. And William Byron in second place behind him. Well, as Mamba Smith, that brilliant NASCAR hype man, would say, they didn't perform when the lights were brightest. The playoffs are great. NASCAR, when is my check coming in the mail? It's been a few days. I was just hoping that I could get that check. My name's Mamba Smith. I want a check from you, NASCAR. You're paying me because the playoffs are really awful, but I'm going to say that they're great and that it encourages teams to step up when the lights are brightest and just like stick and ball sports. It's just like Tom Brady. It's the playoffs are awesome. Okay, a few days, the check will be here. Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, guys, playoffs are absolutely awesome. My name is Mamba Smith. I'm very stupid. William Byron simply didn't perform when the lights were brightest. Therefore, a guy running in like 32nd being a dope completely ruined his day. A second place, possibly a winning run for William Byron. He didn't perform when the lights were brightest, quite frankly. And now he's 15 points out of the playoffs, despite being one of the top point getters all year and be in the contention for the championship if we didn't have the playoffs and we were counting pure points or if we were running the Latford system of the Winston Cup points. But unfortunately, he just did not show up when the lights were brightest because he ran into a guy running 32nd who drove like an idiot and ruined his day and was a really violent wreck. So glad William Byron's okay. Sorry, heavy sarcasm for about the last minute and a half there, but it just infuriates me, that talking point of game seven moments and stepping up when the lights are brightest. Yeah, is it stepping up when Ty Dillon doesn't signal that he's coming to pit road and just cleans out and ends the day of William Byron? Is that, did William Byron fail in some capacity? Is that his fault? He didn't step up and drive hard enough? Absolutely ludicrous, insane, and insulting line of thinking, by the way, right there. Mamba Smith. Oh, Kenny Wallace. All these other guys taking a NASCAR check need to shove it. Danielle Trotta. God. Anyway. Anyway. William Byron, 15 points below the cut line because he didn't step up, apparently. But they're heading into Talladega. You never know what could happen here. I said this last year. I don't care. I don't care about the playoffs. I don't. I don't care. After Logano won last year with the worst finishing position of a champion of all time and with the worst statistical performance of a champion of all time, I don't care. I was like, that's it. I'm not getting invested in any capacity whatsoever to the playoffs. I'm tuning into the races every week because I'm a longtime fan. I've been a fan since I was in diapers. I've been a fan since Dale Earnhardt was on the track. I don't care about the playoffs. I'm tuning in because I want there to be a good race. I just care about the race. I care more about who wins and whether it was a good race every week than I do about playoff standings. I'm not going to pretend to care anymore. I don't. it doesn't matter. You know, like I like Chase Elliott, I like Ross Chastain, I like Josh Berry. Those are my drivers, and I like Kyle Larson fine too, I guess. You know, like you obviously Ross and Berry are no longer in the playoffs. Like if one of those guys won the championship, I'd be like, that's cool, that's great, awesome. But it still would feel kind of cheap. Unless one of those guys, you know, really had dominant year all year, you know, and they really deserved it and everything. But it's just sort of, it would, to me, it's like, all right, that's cool, awesome. I'm happier that Ross Chastain won the Coke 600 this year. That was awesome. I you know, he doesn't get to win all the time. He's not in the greatest car. When Ross wins, I feel great. I'm elated. It's awesome. You know, when Chase wins a race, that's fun. The aftermath of that is fun. I feel great. It's awesome to rewatch it. He won a couple of really exciting races this year. That's awesome. Josh Berry won Las Vegas this year. That was awesome. When I look back on this season, those are the moments that I'm going to remember. I don't give a rat's behind about the playoffs and the champion. I don't. The moments I'm going to remember this year were watching my drivers win. And the exciting races that we did have this year. We had a lot of stinkers. I could talk about how bad the car is for another 3 hours if we want, but I'm not going to do that. But we had some good races. We had some good endings this year. I'm going to remember the ones that my guys won and that was fun to experience and watch, just like I have for the last 30 years. That's the way I feel. And I feel upset with the shills. That's basically it. I feel upset with the shills. The shills that just say that everything is great with the car, everything's great with the format. Fans are tuning out, and the old fans like me, are at the point of not caring. However, that gets us to our next point. Okay. That's about all I have to say about the series and standings. We'll see how Talladega is. They really need to fix this car. The short tracks are god awful, and the plate tracks are disgusting. I watched the last 30 laps of the Winston 500 from 2000, Dale Earnhardt's last win. I watched the last 30 laps of that on the anniversary of that the other day. My God, what I would give for that racing back at the Superstore. What I'd give for that racing back in general, the entire year of 2000. Can I please have the Gen 4 car back with updated safety stuff in it? Can I just have that back? The car was beautiful. The car was perfect. Let's get that back. Let's put the numbers back in the center of the doors. Let's put some power back in those things. Let's widen those gray areas of the rule book a little bit. And let's get back to our roots here. Let's get back to who we really are. But man, that racing was good. I mean, there's space in between the cars. They're bouncing all over the place. The handling matters. They're able to get space in between them and create runs and work through the pack. And it's an art. It's masterful. I highly encourage you, if you're listening, go to NASCAR Classics, the NASCAR Classics website or the NASCAR Classics YouTube page. Look up that 2000 Winston 500 from Talladega. Watch those last 30 laps. And you'll watch them and your jaw will hit the floor and you'll go, I understand why there were millions upon millions of people tuning into this every week. And I understand why those grandstands were full of, 150,000 people or 200,000 people, however many were at Talladega that year. I get it. Yep. You watch that race and there's no fuel saving. They're not bumper to bumper stuck to each other and where you step out of line and you rip a parachute out behind you. God, they need to fix this car. Miss it so much. The last little nugget I wanted to discuss here, though, real quick. The points format is changing next year. We know this. This is pretty much 100% confirmed. We know this. They're going to be moving away from the one race championship. We know this. Where they're moving to, we don't know. We don't know if there's still going to be some kind of playoffs that has like a three-race final round, a four-race final round. We don't know if they're going to go back to some kind of chase system with a reset after 26 and a, you know, top 10 guys in points. We don't know. We have no idea. We don't know if they're going to go back to a 36-race point format. That is exactly what they should do. That is the most legitimate way to crown a champion. It's the way that every other motorsport on earth crowns its champion. They should go to a traditional points counting format. It does not have to be the Latford system. If they want to make points tweaks to encourage aggressiveness for the win or whatever, go ahead. As long as they're totaled up over 36 races and the right person is crowned champion who deserved it, that's what I care about. I don't want guys with average finishing positions of 17.8. I don't want guys who don't deserve to be the champion, to be champion. I want a deserving champion. It's what I think that the vast majority of the fan base, I don't even think it's close, that's what they want. And 36 races is the way to get there. The interesting nugget is how the playoff committee that was convened at the beginning of the year, of all these people to discuss formats and changes and things, they get together and they talk about this stuff. At the beginning of the year, there was apparently only one person on the committee that was from the beginning said 36 races. That's what we need. There was one person. Just about everybody else in the room was kind of acquiesced to, like, we're not going to be able to do that. We have to do some kind of modified thing. This is kind of what I think, blah, blah, blah. We got an article a couple weeks ago that really got some motors running on social media and on the podcasts, because we got an article from Jeff Gluck about how the 36 race point system might have more steam than you think, and that it has gained a ton of momentum in these committee talks in the last, over the course of the year, in the last 7-8 months. The 36 races has emerged as a strong and serious contender. On social media, it's been pertinent for influencers and podcasters and fans to keep voicing their opinion. 36 is the way to go. I don't know what direction they're going to go. I really don't. I don't want to get my hopes up too badly about 36 races. I don't want to, but I have this weird feeling in my gut that I think they're going to do it. And here's why. Because I think they know they're at a crossroads. I think that the leadership, I think NASCAR knows they're at a crossroads. They realize with the television ratings dwindling, I think there was something happened very recently that I think scared the ever-living heck out of them, which was that an F1 race that was on at like 7 o'clock in the morning here or something, or earlier, it got almost as many views as the Cup race that week. I'm trying to remember. It might have been the week of New Hampshire. It could have been the week of Kansas. It was one of those. And the F1 race, NASCAR has had a pretty comfortable lead in viewership over F1 in the United States for a while, even through F1's resurgence and boom worldwide with the Drive to Survive and all this stuff, and the great marketing that they've done over the last few years. They NASCAR has enjoyed a pretty comfortable viewership lead in the United States. And when they turn around in one of their playoff races, again, it was either New Hampshire or Kansas, both of which were solid races, Kansas more so, but when a good race like that is with has F1 on your heels at 7 a.m. on a Sunday, that's a cause for concern. And I think that that in particular is terrifying to them. I think that really might have shook them up more than anything else. The fans whining and complaining, we've been doing that for 20 years since they did the chase. We've been complaining and they ignored us for all those years. They didn't give a shit. The F1 catching them, getting nipping at their heels, I think that's got their attention. And it'll be very interesting to see what happens with the ratings for Talladega. They had 1.7 million viewers at Las Vegas. If they don't crack 2 million at Talladega, that's sound the alarms. That's a problem. That's a big issue. And so we'll have to see. That being said, I have this feeling in my gut. I'm trying not to get my hopes up, but I have this feeling in my gut. I have this feeling that they are on the precipice. We've got the announcement about increasing horsepower. It's going up from 670 to 750. It's not that big of a change. It's happening at the non-mile and a half, so everything a mile and a half, under a mile and a half. It's not that big of a change. It's something. It might help a little with this crappy car. We're not going to see significant change until it's more like 850 or 900, I think. That being said, 750 it's good that we start there. We also probably need to look at some more modifications of the car in the off season, which they might do. But the first and foremost, this crossroads, you have to crown a legitimate champion. And in the process of crowning a legitimate champion, there will be storylines week to week to talk about that promote your stars, that promote your people at the top of the point standings, that promote your star drivers. When we're talking week in and week out about the battle between Chase Elliott, Christopher Bell, William Byron, and Ryan Blaney, and whatever, right? The guys at the top, that's how you create stars. People don't turn on baseball in 2025 and flip through the games and go, man, Miami Marlins, dude, I'm there. No, they go, man, you know, these Dodgers are tearing it up. These Yankees are great. These Mets are exciting. They got this Juan Soto. They tune in. People tune in. And star power drives all sports. People are not amped up to watch Geno Smith duel it out with Dylan Gabriel. That's just not how it works. You need your stars promoted and you need legitimate champions crowned. That's step one, and it costs $0. Their hesitancy with the car is because they have millions of dollars invested, and they, in order to make changes, the teams have to get on board because it's going to cost more money to the teams, et cetera, et cetera. That's a longer process. I understand the holdup. They do need to make changes, but I understand the thought process. I understand the logic there. Okay. With the format, that costs $0 and 0 cents. It starts with crowning a legitimate champion. You crown a legitimate champion. You get people invested week to week. Every race matter. Every position matters. Every point matters. And the cream rises to the top. And you create marketable stars when they're at the top. And it changes year to year. And it gets people invested for each week, for each point, for every position. And every driver, I've said this before, because of, they try so hard to win because of the playoffs. Every driver wants to win every race all the time, and they would do anything and everything. They'd wreck their mother if it meant winning the race. It creates intrigue. It creates organic excitement. Are there going to be years, just like there was in the Latford system under the Winston Cup, are there going to be years where somebody runs away with it and they just have to start their car in the last race, or they wrap it up two races from the end? Yes, there are. Undoubtedly. But that's what makes the years where it's a compelling battle, when there's 3, 4, 5, 6 guys that could win it in the last race of the year. That's what makes it a compelling, that's what makes it game 7. That's what makes it exciting. It doesn't happen every year. The playoffs, we want to create game 7 moments. Well, it's not game 7 if it happens every year. It loses its intrigue. It loses its value. That's what crowning a legitimate champion brings back. It brings back 92 Atlanta. It brings back those tremendous battles down the stretch. Guys swapping spots, and I think the 87 battle was a great one with Earnhardt and Waltrip. It's what brings those great battles back. Down the stretch for the championship, when every position, every point, and every race matters. For Denny Hamlin, the next 2 weeks don't matter. Does he want to win? Would he wreck his mother to win the next 2 weeks? Sure would. But it has nothing to do with the playoffs. Does he want to finish good? Yeah. And again, does he want to win? Yeah. He does every week. Every time that guy gets in a race car, he wants to be the best. Does he have to be, though, to win the championship? Nope. Under the old system, under a 36-race system, does he have to be good next week and the week after and the week after that? Yes. That's going to do it for this episode of the Victory Cigar Podcast. Thank you all for listening. This is a pretty long one today. Thank you all for listening. You can follow me at Victory Cigar Pod on Twitter, and be sure to follow the podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I will see you guys for another episode, hopefully soon, and we'll keep going over these hot button issues and these interesting topics throughout the world of sports. Victory Cigar Pod on Twitter. And be sure to leave feedback underneath the comments section on the episode on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, as well as tweet me if you have any questions. I will be more than happy to have a fan questions segment that we can do during the show if I receive questions on social media or in the comments. So thank you all for listening, and I'll see you again soon.